Hello, Steve Jobs here.
Hey, Jacques, yeah, how are you?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
Very, very well. Yeah, exciting time to be alive. Tell me, Steve, instead of me busily writing down things as you say and so forth, would it be okay if we record the conversation for my convenience?
It would be just fine, and I'll record it on my end as well.
Wonderful, yeah. So then we can fire back and forth with who's got the best quality recording. Huh?
Yeah.
This to me is the topic we're going to discuss here is something I think many universities have a keen interest in. And as I did my layout in the email is the shift of finances away from government sources and onto students. And I just this week saw another report on the increase in tuition. Obviously, student debt is now higher than credit card debt. It seems clearly like an unsustainable model. Living on a campus and looking at student seg fees and all the cool things they do, like want to break down a perfectly good union to build an even fancier and bigger one, and all the types of fancy services they want to provide for students just create, obviously, a bigger demand for taxing students for this. So I'm introducing this kind of just with some of the things I've seen. One thing I've seen, for example, in California is that students that normally would go straight to a prestigious university now hang back and say, let me do the community college and then transfer to that fancy place because why should I pay $40,000 for general education? And so starting to make financial decisions in where they're going with the future. And, of course, then you get all the, disruptive technologies that are, weighing into the market and so forth. So that's my view as I see it right now. And I'm really interested to hear from, your research and what you've seen and connected with people of, do you see any disruption or surprises possibly coming down the road in the behavior of students away from the traditional path of, you're going to go to a college where dad went and so and so and so.
Yeah. Now, I don't have specific research on this, so I should be very clear about that.
Sure.
I haven't surveyed students or anything like that.
Yeah.
I actually think of, just as an aside, think of students properly so-called as not a good source of survey data because that represents a specific demographic, specifically those people who have been able to afford to go to university.
Yeah.
I'm always hesitant when people talk about, well, the students want this, students want that. I always say, well, yeah, but what did the 7-Eleven clerk want? Because that's the more significant piece of data to me, and nobody surveys 7-Eleven clerks, certainly not about university. And I find that to be a weakness. I say 7-Eleven clerk because I funded several years at university by working at 7-Eleven, so
it rings home.
It does. Having said that, I think that we're already seeing signs of significant disruption, and these signs are simply the tens of thousands, and in some cases hundreds of thousands of people signing up for these massive open online courses.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I recognize that large numbers of the people who sign up don't even do the first assignment, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, many thousands of people are doing that, and I think what this shows is that there is significant pent-up demand for free and open access to online learning, and secondly, that the technology has arrived to provide that, at least to a certain degree.
Totally, yeah.
And I've even seen, in fact, I have a link going in my newsletter today, but I've seen this before as well, reports that some universities are looking at MOOCs as a way of addressing the whole first-year course thing where people enter university and they're not even sure they want to be there, and they're amassing big, huge debts, and they're not sure if they can succeed, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And opening up these first-year courses and offering them online as MOOCs would make it possible for people to learn for themselves whether they want to be in such and such a program. Of course,
yeah.
The problem is these first-year courses are the big money raisers for universities.
Yes.
So there's a bit of a backward market logic there. If, you know, if they were trying to address their economic issues, they'd be trying to turn their, you know, the fourth-year and graduate courses into MOOCs and focusing on raking in the money from the first-year courses. In general, I think, you know, I mean, you've seen the numbers, I've seen the numbers, the trillions of dollars of student debt and all of that. I think it's clear that the model is unsustainable. It's worse in the U.S. right now simply because there has been this inflation of tuition. Lots of arguments about what the cause of that is. I've read that, you know, things like Pell Grants and other support for tuition and education costs are actually raising for tuitions or removing from universities the incentive to keep tuitions low.
Well, it's just the same as I think with insurance and healthcare. You know, do I really need to be insured to be able to buy a pair of glasses?
Well, that's an interesting case. You know, I mean, now of course I'm. It's interesting that you bring up healthcare because I'm on the Canadian side of things with respect to healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I go to the doctor, I just go to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the expenses don't come into play unless, you know, I start buying prescription medicine or something that isn't covered under the healthcare plan.
Yeah.
And we actually spend less per capita in Canada on healthcare and receive better outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on average than in the United States. So
I think you've touched on something actually quite interesting, and this is this the grant system of it is just, I think of it as a student, you do not realize you're on the hook here, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
You just think, oh, I got money to go to college. And the full impact is not there, and then so then we all ride the same wave. It's nice money to be made. For universities, it's easy. We can raise the cost. It doesn't really have an impact. Students keep coming back, but now I think the reality has sunk in a little more, and we realize this is just not the way forward.
Well, the reality has sunk in, but I think it's important to understand the logic and the rationale on the part of the student, at least on the part of the student, on the part of students like me. Now, I'm a different demographic.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the kids who go straight from high school to university funded by their parents.
Yeah.
That's a different demographic. I can't even comprehend that demographic because I'm so far from it.
Mm-hmm.
But here's how it worked for me and is probably more along the lines of how it works for people who are running up these loans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this. I can get my education. My education is a ticket to a better life, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever they do to me in the future, they can't take the education back.
Correct.
So to me, you know, it was worth whatever financial sacrifice I was going to make because what I was going to get would be worth whatever that hardship was.
Yeah.
And that's what drives people forward. And it's, you know, and it's so often represented in terms of, well, getting the degree to get the job and things like that. But it's not that. It's getting the knowledge. And I think people understand, maybe not explicitly, but at a certain level, that it's not simply about learning stuff by reading the books. It's about learning in a learning environment, you know, going through that period of time where you're focused on learning and focused on doing something more, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember really clearly, because I spent time in the workforce before university, and I spent time in the workforce after university, well after university, because I graduated in the middle of a depression, when that was the 80s, right? Miserable time to be looking for work, at least in Canada. And, you know, I knew I could just learn stuff by figuring it out. I was working in the computer industry, and I taught myself to program and was doing some fairly advanced programming. But I also knew there was this whole socialization aspect. And that was brought home to me very clearly by the fact that the company would promote university graduates and wouldn't promote me. And it wasn't a knowledge thing.
Yeah, the glass ceiling. Yep.
Yeah, and it wasn't even a credential thing. It was they were more inclined to trust the university graduates, and they never really did trust me.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so you sort of have that feeling of being on the outside.
Yeah.
And, you know, and for people who attend university late or have difficulty, I don't think that feeling ever goes away. But you get that feeling. And so accessing university isn't simply about accessing knowledge. It's about getting yourself kind of on the inside of what you were previously outside of.
Exactly right.
So the elite universities know this really well, I think. And I think their market is solid because they provide privileged access to the inside of very elite inner circle.
And I think the when you go to students to look at recruiting, if you go to University of Podunkville, there's no one there recruiting.
Yeah.
And then when you go to Ivy League Silver Top, you find everybody's there wanting those kids, and we'll start you out at six figures.
Yeah.
And so the logic is you want to get to Ivy League Silver Top because you're going to get a serious job, and you've got your future made. But Podunkville College is not going to take you places if you have that mindset and you've got the financial means to go there.
Exactly. You know, and again, I see this in my career. And again, it's representative employment, but forget that even, right? I graduated from the University of Calgary, and I also studied at the University of Alberta. These are two excellent universities. I've had the chance to compare, you know, the intellectual capacity of people who studied at those universities as compared to Harvard or MIT or Stanford, because I've met lots of people from all of those universities, and they compare very well. The people who come out of the U of A and the U of C are, you know, whip smart, crackerjack, top of their field. But, you know, it's not just the job thing. It's, you know, who's recommended if you need a contact to quote in a newspaper? Who's recommended if you need somebody to sit on an advisory committee for a development project? Who's recommended even if you're looking at program and evaluation committees for awards or things like that? Now, there's a whole range of things, and I've just picked three off the top of my head. There's a whole range of things where... you know, the fact that this person is from Yale, they have an in, where this person from Calgary doesn't have an in.
Yeah.
Now, MOOCs and online learning aren't going to change that. They're not going to affect that one bit.
Yeah.
But what they might do, I hope, is separate the aspect of learning from the aspect of social exclusion. If we do that, we can do something about the problem that is social exclusion. But we can only do that if we have an understanding that people, no matter where they are, can acquire this high capacity to learn. And that hasn't been established with the traditional university system. They've tried very hard. and to some degree in some places succeeded, but overall, you know, I mean, like all the community colleges, all the universities of Calgary out there, who again are very good at what they do, which is the same thing Yale does, they haven't established the general perception of having graduates that are equal in caliber and quality. And so, it's unfortunate.
So, Stephen, if you look at MOOCs, and if you're obviously from a well-branded institution, the MOOC works for you, the fleas, or rather the butterflies, you know, come to the flowers. But if you look at an average institution, you know, what would you say would be their business model to engage in producing, not just allowing their students to go for MOOCs, but participate in the production and execution of MOOCs?
That's a great question because, yeah, and we've seen, I've seen especially closely how people flock to the MOOCs from Stanford and don't flock to the MOOCs from Empire. The MOOCs from Empire are anyway inferior in quality. In fact, I know they're not.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, they don't have Stanford's PR department pushing them, and they don't have that whole glow of being from the elite. So what is the reason? My thinking is, and it's a bit heretical.
I'm interested.
Yeah. That the any institution that isn't an elite, which is to say all but about a dozen of them, are going to have to rethink their mandate. And right now their mandate is to provide education for people who are smart enough and can pay the fees. And they're really serious about those criteria, especially the smart enough one, right? You know, you have to be admitted to a university. That's a big deal. You know, as though, and in fact, as it was, something scarce. They need to change their mandate to, our mandate is to educate everyone. And by everyone, I mean absolutely, literally everyone. You, me, your children, my children. I would even extend it to dogs, cats, and smart goldfish if I could.
But they can't raise their hand when you ask for them to step forward.
There are some drawbacks with the university education for pets. But but you see how this changes, right? And why would I say that? Well, it's again, it's almost the model of universal health care. There are some significant differences, but we can leave that aside. In the sense that they go from being something that really, you know, only the select few get to go to, and then they have the in and everybody else is out. Something everybody has access to and is a part of. And even if you don't, you know, it's like a MOOC, right? Even if you don't go all the way to the end, it was pretty cool kind of being there at the start and watching the big guys do their thinking. It's not exclusive anymore. And what happened, I think, you know, this needs to be empirically proven, although, again, the healthcare system is a good example of this. What happens, I think, is if the universities or the university system in general, because they may still need to do a fair amount of rationalization, if the university system sees its mandate as providing, you know, the materials for an education for everyone, then their business model changes from charging those few who can actually get in to being supported by everyone, in other words, by society as a whole. And it's exactly the reverse of where the model has been going in the United States now, where there's been less and less and less government support for universities. Now it's down to almost nothing.
And
you can see how the system's getting worse and worse and worse and worse as a result. And universities are raising tuition and et cetera. Flip that around. Flip it around so that the university says, look, we're just going to educate everyone. Now, of course, you have a chicken and egg problem, how you get to that point. But I think that once you remove the idea of the university as something really exclusive for rich people and smart people only, then you have the basis for public support and increased rather than decreased funding.
But let me throw a wrench in your direction and see if you can duck fast enough.
Yep. If I can duck a wrench, I can duck a dodgeball.
I'm thinking now, let me create a funny one. Let's say the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point is offering a MOOC in American history.
Mm-hmm.
And so is one of your 12 choice universities.
Mm-hmm.
Where will you want to go?
Well, yeah, you put it like that. You'd go to the one with choice university.
You will definitely be more attracted to the higher brand would attract you. In other words, it does not favor the quality of outright favor the quality of the smaller institution, and people will flock to the bigger thing, and thus the smaller university will have less of a draw. They will still be basically in the same pot. They now are putting their resources and their efforts into a very noble idea of educating everybody and getting no money for it. And the government should look at this and say, listen, Ivy League's Silver Top is already offering this, and I think they're doing pretty grand. You guys should, shouldn't duplicate services here.
Yeah, absolutely. But we know, and I know, that what the Ivy League is doing is taking some content and broadcasting it to the web, and that's their MOOC. We also know that even though they're an Ivy, even though they're an elite, they have limited resources.
I would counter that if I compare them with us. UW Stevens Point and say,
yeah,
their endowment is pretty big. That's why MIT can do some fancy stuff, because they can basically abandon the financial model, suspend it for a while, because they can afford to suspend it. Other universities are on the ropes.
Yeah, and absolutely. So if I'm the small university, what I'm thinking is a history course. I can't compete going it alone, but if I'm working with all of the other institutions who want to offer a history MOOC, now I've got something interesting.
In other words, you do a hybrid MOOC with a large collaborative of other universities all joining to develop one MOOC, or how do you see that shape?
Yeah, well, that's it exactly, although be careful with the word develop, right?
Okay.
People have this idea of MOOCs as almost like, traditional online learning that we saw 15 years ago, where we have these packages of materials that will be presented over a sequence of time to people, right?
Okay.
And so you have to spend all this time developing your content, developing your tasks, creating your videos, things like that.
Yeah.
But the model of MOOCs really, let me say it this way. The model of MOOCs that we developed originally weren't developed that way. These MOOCs were essentially MOOCs that evolved as learning communities. So we would throw resources at people, but we wouldn't spend a whole pile of time creating resources. We would find what we already had and throw that into the mix. And we would tell people who were enrolled in our courses to find what they had and throw that into the mix. And then the activity in the MOOC became the activity around all of this material that was thrown into the mix and new resources that people created out of that.
But doesn't this sound a little bohemian, like a bunch of hippies teaching each other to tie-dye? And
well, it would sound like that, but the thing is, what we also throw into the mix are the experts, right?
Okay.
So it's not just a bunch of hippies teaching each other how to tie-dye. It's a bunch of hippies and the world's best tie-dye people teaching each other how to tie-dye.
Okay, that's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, so, it as I kept reminding people over and over, this is not constructivism, right?
Okay.
The experts don't just stand off to the side. Rather, they get right into the middle of the mix and do what they do.
Right? Yeah.
That's very different from the model of MIT and the rest of them, right, where their experts present.
Yep, right. Exactly.
Here,
so you see,
the experts get into the crowd and do what they do, and the crowd can be right there doing the same thing with them.
Now, interesting, in a conversation with many faculty recently, as we gathered around to discuss this MOOC thing, I noticed already we differ quite a bit in how we see what is a MOOC. In other words, the fact that it's online, that it's massive, you know, and it's open. Well, that's a MOOC, but how it's constituted, in other words, the way you describe it, some might say, oh, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
And I think the diversity will be, now I've coined a new term, which I call a SMOOC, and the S being a dollar sign. You know,
yeah.
And I see SMOOCs also now becoming because there's the pressure to go beyond the free and you know. So I think that maybe the future will be universities will start looking at SMOOCs, you know.
Well, yeah, but now keep in mind, right? The big advantage, this whole openness and accessibility, now is being curtailed, right? There's no doubt, you know, and you can see the dollar signs in Thomas Friedman's eyes when he writes about MOOCs. There's no doubt people are thinking, oh, yeah, this will be like the Napster of education.
Uh-huh.
Or, you know, to modernize it, like the Netflix of education, where you look at a menu, you click on a show you want to watch, and you watch the show, and maybe you do some things, but mostly it's about watching the show and texting to your friends, maybe, because, you know, because it's kind of like The Walking Dead, where you all watch it and then you text each other, did you see that?
Yeah.
Right, and, you know, maybe a few of the really creative people might do zombie walks or something like that. But, you know, once you start charging people for that experience, if it's not entertainment, The Walking Dead is entertainment, but if it's not entertainment, then what you're doing is now you're throwing up these barriers to being, you know, not simply to education, as I said, but being, you know, getting to be part of that in-group, to be in the know, in, you know, not excluded, not on the outside. And, you know, they're talking about reasonable fees. A lot of reasonable fees are, what, $25, $30 a course? These aren't, you know, you start aggregating these, you're still looking at thousands of dollars over a degree. So, you know, and then add to that the cost of the materials, because, of course, the open access books or open e-books that people used to have, now they will charge reasonable fees for those as well, to follow Flat World Knowledge's example.
Yeah.
And so now you're paying $24.95 for a course, you're paying another reasonable fee of $15 to $20 for your book, not to mention the cost of your internet access, and you need high-speed access because, of course, now you're watching streaming video and all of that, and that's costing you about as much as your cable subscription.
Right.
And you're finding yourself looking at, you know, an annual cost of several thousand dollars, and what they've succeeded in doing is lowering the price point, but not by much, and still preserving their status as elite. And as the place where you really want to be in person, it's kind of like the TED model of learning, right?
Yeah, but you know, I mean, let's explore that point. In other words, I'm you will clearly see from me, I'm exploring these different things without emotionally settling specifically or kind of putting my hopes in one bag. I'm looking at straighterline.com, for example.
Sorry, looking at where?
Straighterline.com.
Straighterline, okay.
You're familiar with them?
Yeah.
Now, the nice thing that Burke has done there is, you know, it's accredited courses that he offers. So you don't, in other words, so someone who wants to get a degree and follow the traditional path can uh-huh. go there, you know, pay your $50 for the course and $100 per month, and if you fast, $150, and you've got your class done. That offers, and the accreditation piece that's part of it, that offers a significant reduction. And I'll give you a classic example. I was teaching Afrikaans. I am actually this semester teaching Afrikaans 102. It's open courseware. It's an open environment. The whole world can see it. And I use the environment as my textbook, so I'm following nice protocol and saving people the money piece for their textbooks and so forth.
Yeah.
I got a guy called me from Germany, or emailed me from Germany, said, you know, I've got an Afrikaans roommate, and I've picked up quite a bit, and because it's so close to German, I feel I could slip into 102 instead of 101. In fact, he could have slipped into 201.
Yeah.
But any case, so I said, man, yeah, I'd love to have you in the class. So he said, how do I take it? I sent him the URL for the people that deal with what they call, you know, your non-traditional student. He came back to me and he said, well, at something like $2,965 for the class, I don't think I'm going to go there.
Yeah.
So I thought, yeah, you know, roughly $3,000. I said, I would agree with you, definitely. And I passed that information on to powers that be to say, we really got to look at this. For someone to take to pay $3,000 for an online class because it's just his interest, it's not going places. And we can argue all we want why this is justified. Well, guess what? This bumblebee is not going to fly. So
just as a quick aside, because we laugh at those costs, but I've also looked into corporate learning, and like $3,000 for a class is not out of line in corporate learning. If
that exactly.
$3,000 for a three-day course. I mean, like, you know, so that's the market rate these days.
You know, and so it's actually insightful that you bring that point up. But then you have to ask yourself, well, Afrikaans 102, that's not something the world is chasing after.
Yeah.
And so yet when you come up with some highly specialized knowledge that will give your company the total edge,
mm-hmm.
You can double the cost, we'll still do it, because what that knowledge is going to do to our processes and give us the advantage and make us money, we've got it figured out, buddy. We want it.
Yeah.
So that's a totally different logic. And you know, so your poor student says, I just want my bachelor's. That guy can't play this game and participate. So, yeah, so it's interesting to define the background to these markets and what, you know, tolerance points there are in different pricing structures.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think the StraighterLine.com, because what I see in them, for example, is they would start to eat the lunch of general education for many universities, and that's where they focused. Is on GE. So if they take care of that, and so students say, well, I can either go to the community college or do StraighterLine because I'm working and that's really convenient for me and the accreditation is in place, maybe I'll go that way. And that means you show up at the university and you say, okay, let's dig into my major. My GE is done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the old adage I always have is some would resist taking these guys because they want to not, you know, undermine their own program, and other people will say, well, this is a disruptive technology I cannot ignore, and we would love to have your students, thank you.
Yeah. It's going to depend a lot on the experience StraighterLine can offer. Again, it's not simply about the accreditation and the credential.
Yeah,
and it really is represented a lot that way. But again, we go back to who are we surveying to find out how important these things are, right? You know,
yeah.
Survey students, yeah, okay. Students will say it's about the credential, if they, you know, or some such thing. But I think it's more complex than that. And you know, there's still a barrier being thrown up by StraighterLine. I'm not sure what I'm just trying to type silently here. to see what their rates are. Do you know what their rates are just off the top of your
Yes,
head?
I do. It's $49 to be on the money. It's $49 per course and $99 per month.
Oh,
while,
okay.
While you're enrolled.
Yeah, so, okay, there's right in line with the quote-unquote reasonable fees that I was talking about for MOOCs. Then.
Yeah.
So let's say you're looking at, let's say, you know, a typical semester or a typical year of 10 classes, 10 months worth of work, so that's about $500 for the classes plus, it looks like another $200 just for the monthly charges, so $700 for a year. That's a lot less than, clearly, you know, a typical American university. It's even less than what's offered in Canada. The question is, first of all, will that price point stay the same all the way up through to the degree when it becomes more and more expensive to be offering courses to people? Will that price point stay constant over time? And will that price point get people not simply access to courses that are credentialed, but also entrance into this community of people who have earned an education? And it's that third thing, I think, that's the biggest challenge. That's why I like the MOOC so much, is it embeds you into the community of people and doesn't look at university simply as acquiring knowledge. But if Straighter Line can pull that off, I think they would have to pull it off by joining MOOCs or, you know, accessing MOOCs in some way. Then the model could work. But I think it would still only work with people, it would only work with people who have about $1,000 of disposable income a year to spend on education. A lot of people don't. Mm-hmm. Most of the world doesn't.
Yeah, that is a good one. So the big question is, if a desperate, smaller university with limited branding recognition come to you and say, Stephen, as what you've seen out there, what can we do now to avoid the papaya hitting our fan 3, 4, 5 years down the road? Is there a way we can position ourselves now so that when these disruptive things start to happen and you see the game changing, that we would be agile and able to respond and not then say, oh, we need to change, we need to figure it out, but that we can do that earlier?
If I was a university president, which I never will be, but if I was, my strategy would be based around the principle of making myself indispensable to the community. And I know that seems like a totally different mission than most institutions have, but, you know, when you think about it, that is the claim that universities already make, is that they are indispensable. But I would really focus on making that my bottom line, being indispensable to the community. Because when financial push comes to financial shove, as it will sooner probably, if not later, then when you are indispensable to the community, there is more of a likelihood that the community will come to your aid.
In what way? Because, I mean, this what you're saying now sounds like, yeah, but if I have to say, he's just a politician, he's just throwing you some nice stuff, what does that mean? Can any of you tell me? I think many would say, no, not really, but it sounds good. Well, how would you translate that into a little more of a concrete thing of what would make you indispensable and what aid can they offer you?
Yeah, well, now we're getting into some really good questions. Here's an example of one of the things that the University of Alberta has done, and they're not the only ones to have done this, but I just happened to have walked through it a while back, so I know it's there.
Mm-hmm.
Is they occupied an old Sears store in downtown Edmonton. It's a department store that had closed, and they turned it into a community knowledge and business incubation center. Where people can come in, take advantage of the university's resources, and build their own business. Now, the university is doing that, obviously, in cooperation with the city of Edmonton and who knows what companies. But the idea here is that the university sees itself not simply as, you know, offering courses to rich people, but getting into the community and helping the community develop and progress.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there have been lots of cases of incubation centers around in different communities, and then I'm sure you've seen many and I've seen many. But when you have the university, which, you know, is one of the largest employers and certainly one of the largest repositories of knowledge, skills, and ability in the community, in there wholeheartedly trying to make it work. Now this incubation center goes from, you know, a nice idea to something that really is beginning to turn out product, where the product in this case is successful businesses, people who are no longer on unemployment and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one example.
That is a good idea.
Another example is university involvement in the education system generally. Right now, for example, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, but
mm-hmm.
but I still think these are useful ideas and people can modify them and actually make them good. But our school systems pay thousands, millions of dollars every year for learning materials. Learning materials that could and maybe should be produced by people who are expert at producing learning materials. In other words, universities.
Yeah.
I would think that it would be a significantly useful investment of university time and effort to work on a project to make learning materials and learning activities, and et cetera, available for free to community schools. And you think about what's happening here, right? It's not simply that the university is sharing their creativity with the school, but they're also, by this interaction, preparing the kids who are in school for their eventual relation with the university. And you know, when the university is involved with children who are in kindergarten, grade one, grade two, they see the university as the place you learn from.
Mm.
And the place you will always learn from.
Yeah.
Right? And when you need to know something, right, you know, where do you go? You go to the university, or you talk to a professor, or you connect with, you know, again, back to the world of MOOCs, you connect with the history community that's online that has real historians in it doing real history, but that is open and is shared with you, with your community, and, you know, with several dozen universities across the country. You see how the perception changes?
I do. Yeah, that's actually very well illustrated of how the university and the community definitely see that this partnership is a livelihood to the community and not mm-hmm. just a thing there where some go to. Yeah.
It's funny because it really involves a change of mindset, right? And I think it'll be really hard for the university to do, but the change of mindset has got to be, a change from this idea that we're the elite, we're the best, we're the unique repository of excellence, we make the call, etc., to this is something, you know, like nobody's on the outside anymore. Everybody's on the inside. This is a community thing that we're all doing together for each other. Yeah.
And the power in what I see in what you say is, you know, often marginalized minority communities
mm-hmm.
with previous generations never having gone to college,
mm-hmm.
they feel the university is a kind of often it's a white man thing and or you know, it's not for me, even if it's not on a race basis, it's just not our family thing.
Yep.
And so there have been, you know, obviously white families in that same game that, no, we guys yep. don't do that thing, you know.
Yeah.
And that way, what you're saying is They've met these people, they've touched some of what they've done and so forth, and the engagement there wasn't bad at all, and they feel differently about learning itself then.
Yeah, and you go out to the community and meet with people in the community on their own terms, you know, and like the university right now makes everyone come to them, and you're allowed in if, you know, you have been weighed, measured, and found wanting or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, it has to be that change of attitude. It's interesting you mentioned, you know, the excluded communities, because one of my major formative influences early in my teaching career was going to Northern Alberta, into communities, into First Nations communities, and also some of the rural communities, and teaching right in these locations, and it had a powerful impact on me. And you know, I came from a small town. I came from a place where people really didn't go to university, and so I understand exactly that kind of effect.
So, what was the impact? As you look at, you know, what you've seen with universities reaching out to communities, you definitely see in a substantive impact that you see, yep, this is working. It's not just a theoretical nicety. It is really playing out already.
Well, yeah, it's really hard to measure that impact. I mean, I saw the impact on individual lives where people who would otherwise have had, you know, a not very successful life, a life, you know, with a lot of poverty and a lot of the stuff that goes with poverty, you know. And, you know, I had students coming to my classes, women with black eyes, you know. There was stuff like that. And moving from that into, you know, good-paying professional careers with lives that were free of, you know, sickness and violence and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
To say that there was this magical effect across the entire community as a result of these initiatives would be a gross exaggeration. These communities still struggle. They all struggle. You know, First Nations, white, whatever, they all struggle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the factors for this go well beyond access to a university education. But, you know, I'd love to see the university system see this as a problem they should be attempting to address, mm-hmm. rather than looking at these people as simply not qualified, you know?
Yeah. Now, there's one last question that's kind of nagging and always in the back of my mind that I don't ask too many people, but I see this as an interesting issue, and that is, if you look at the purpose of education,
mm-hmm.
especially higher ed, my preface is always this: when the enemy army invades your country and they seizing control, they often go to the university and round up the professors.
Yeah.
They don't go to the technical college to round up the instructors there. And the reason, obviously, is because, you know, they want to get rid of the intelligentsia that will, with lucidity, counter them and give them trouble. So in that sense, I'm wondering, does a university still focus on providing that kind of discerning citizen that they educate you to be able to make good assessment of what information is verified, what's accurate, and so forth, and have a more superior judgment, you know? Or is it mainly focusing on getting you skilled so that you can participate in the economy and move on, and you're attractive because you've got the know-how of what we need and there's a good match?
I think there's two stories here. I think one story is the story that is told especially to the politicians, but also to the business community and to some extent the public, which is the story about knowledge and jobs and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
The other story, I think, is the story universities tell internally. Not so much explicitly, but often by their actions and their values, and that is the, you know, the whole idea of the purpose of education being the empowerment of an individual to govern and manage their own lives reasonably, rationally, making their own choices, their own decisions, etc. And again, I don't think they say it explicitly, but you know, in the very nature of the way they conduct themselves, the whole idea of the collegial environment, the whole idea of, to a large degree, in a university environment, the learner managing themselves. When I went to university, very few, if any, of my classes actually took attendance. It would be surprising if they did. There was a great degree of flexibility and freedom in the assignments that I chose. That's not true in all disciplines, of course. In engineering, for example, especially in the lower years or in the sciences, it's very different. I took a significant number of courses in the sciences, which are interesting, challenging, but really very rigid and very structured, and therefore not nearly as much fun. But even that changes as you progress through the university system, and you always know, even when you're taking these courses, that you know the ultimate objective is to be one of these reasonable, reflective, critical thinkers, a free agent in the scientific community. It's a value. And it's funny because I have a course on critical literacies that I did once before, and I'm going to do again. And it's based, in large part on the logic courses, the very same courses that I taught in Northern Alberta, in fact, because I found that such a powerful, powerful course, simply because people came into the course expecting to be receivers of knowledge and left the course as people who were able to critically assess and form their own opinions. I just loved teaching that course. And I was thinking, the way to market this course is, this is the education, first of all, that you don't get in your schools, because you don't. You don't get it until you get to university, typically. And it's the education they don't tell you about. And again, it's this perspective of being on the inside and being on the outside. If you're on the outside of the university system, you never learn about this, because all the talk about jobs and knowledge and productive units of society and all of that, when you're on the inside of university, then you begin to see this whole concept of critical reflection, self-awareness, forming your own opinions, having these logical tools, everything ranging from, critical reasoning to understanding probability, even to things like, how to articulate yourself, clearly, etc. I've seen, you've probably seen these programs about projects, in the projects, about even correcting people's accents and pronunciation and that, which is going way over the top, because it's not about that at all. It's all about making your own decision, but they've mistaken the appearance for the reality. But the concept is there's this way of approaching life that you get on the inside, and they don't talk about it.
So university is kind of meant to be a finishing school of sorts.
Very much so. Hugely so. And the people who don't go to university, you can see they don't have that finish.
And
there's a strong correlation, I would suggest, and somebody should measure this for me, or maybe has measured this, between the amount of finish, that's a good term, right? The amount of finish you project and actually have, and how much success you have. Now, of course, finish is only, it doesn't prevail over all of the other factors. There's all the connections and things like that that you get in Yale. Even if you were a boor, an uneducated boor who went to Yale, you can still become president because you have the connections. So it's not all about the finish. But there's this thing, that this capacity for self-actualization that you acquire, that isn't even talked about, but I think still prevails as a value in university. And if universities could learn to promote that and make that possible for everybody, but not in the sense of, we will give you self-actualization.
Well, I'm just thinking William Perry's theory of intellectual development, you know, of how the first-year students think very much binary, and then it goes up to multiplicity, then relativism, and then commitment and relativism. As that process happens, it takes, you know, this engagement in higher learning, migrate you along that path of becoming more sophisticated in your thinking. And so it's an interesting question is, will that engagement happen? Because I know a number of very skilled people in different areas that did not go through that intellectual development necessarily. And they remain largely and proudly so more binary thinkers.
Yeah, but they've made the decision to be that. And that's why that particular theory is a bit misleading, right? There isn't some progressive path to the truth or the best way to look at the world. But the path that people progress is they become more and more able to make these decisions for themselves. I've known people as well. I have a brother who's like this. Bill, if you're listening, this is for you. Who are very proudly binary thinkers.
Yep.
Right? But have acquired enough experience and education and capacity in life that over time they've been able to make this decision for themselves. And if you challenge them on it, they can make it stick.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
Yeah,
I've got no problem with that. I would never vote the way they do, but I have no problem with that because it's their choice.
Sure.
And it's this capacity for choice which is created.
I've got to wrap up here in 2 minutes or so, but, I'm thinking of it's their choice. In a way, I think the way in which your environment and which the input and, the whole nurturing that you find in environment shapes you a lot, and university has shaped me greatly, in my thinking, and I'm thinking of binary thinkers that I know, they've not had that rich exposure, and it's definitely played a role. Now, you can definitely say there are some people with not much exposure, but still have that wisdom kind of innately in them to gravitate in the right direction, and then you would say choice is there, but the nurture-nature thing maybe has got its path here, and I'm just wondering if this fully online thing and targeted more towards what the market needs will deliver that kind of a polished person that you're hoping to have.
In that sense, maybe finish is the wrong word, because I don't care about polish.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care about nuance.
See, what I mean by polished is just sharp thinkers.
Yeah.
You can't pull the wool over the eyes. They are astute in their thinking. That's polished to me. Now, having the accent right and all that kind of stuff, that's other people's view of polished. I'm really going for this person has gained, a valuable education, even though they got their rugged ways from the backcountry where they come from. That I don't get distracted by that.
Yeah, well, and maybe this is the secret to these elite universities, is they make sure that everybody who goes to them gets at least that. And the shall we say lesser universities have, drunk the Kool-Aid of job readiness and skills and things like that. So, I would hate to generalize and say all universities provide all graduates with keen critical awareness. I think that would be a silly statement.
Sure.
But I think it's a fair statement to say that there's still a great deal of respect for that value within the university community generally.
Definitely.
First of all, and secondly, they don't talk much about it outside that community.
Yeah. Well, this has been just wonderful to reflect as where we stand now in history and look at this and to, heard your astute observations. Thank you so much for taking this time, Stephen.
Oh, no problem.
Always just delightful to visit with you. Thank you so much. And, you know, anytime if you want to reflect more on this, I'm always open for this kind of thing. It's just exhilarating to engage in this with someone that has a keen interest in this as well.
It's pretty fun, isn't it?
Yeah. Much appreciated.
Then.
Thank you then.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.